Welcome to Books and Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Jo Littler from City University of London about her new book, Against Meritocracy, Culture, Power and Myths of Mobility. So welcome to Books and Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Jo Littler, who is a reader in cultural industries at City University of London, about her new book, Against Meritocracy, Culture, Power and the Myths of Mobilities. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This is a really great book. It's kind of completely of the moment. You know, we've got both in the UK, certainly in the States, Australia, to an extent, you know, almost globally, these conversations about meritocracy, social mobility, inequality, and the book addresses that kind of right up front. And I wonder if you could say a bit about where the book has kind of come from, where it fits maybe into your kind of broader intellectual agenda.
Well, I think I first got interested in the idea of meritocracy about 13 years ago, I think it was, when I wrote a piece for Soundings, the Journal of Politics and Culture, which was about celebrity. And I was very interested in how celebrity intersected with individualism and social mobility. You know, why it was, for example, that celebrities would seem keen to talk about how they remained in the class that they came from. Sometimes, such as Jenny from the Block, Jennifer Lopez, talking about how she was still rooted in her working class community whilst being a megastar, earning lots of bling. And then also, you know, the kind of the way in which the intersection between the ordinary and the extraordinary works with celebrity kind of taps into a whole series of issues around social mobility in general. And the idea of being a celebrity, I guess, is a kind of a meritocratic trope as well. It's the idea that anyone can make it. And so that piece was, it kind of looked at some of the tensions around that trope and some of the different ways in which it was expressed. But that's when I really got interested in this notion of meritocracy and, you know, began to put a name on these kind of ideas and discourses of social mobility that were being popularized at that time.
The obvious question is, what are we actually talking about here? What is meritocracy? And early on in the book, you kind of give, I guess, maybe like two facets of it, you know, a kind of social system and then a broad sort of ideology or kind of set of, I guess, ideas. And I wonder if you could like sketch those two elements of meritocracy by way of giving us a definition.
Okay. So, yeah, loosely in its kind of common or garden everyday meaning, meritocracy refers to the idea that you have a society in which you can have enough social mobility and flexibility for people to work hard and activate their inner talent and use that to propel themselves up the social pile. So it refers to this social system on the one hand, and that's a kind of relatively static meaning of the word. Then you also have the fact that meritocracy ends in ocracy, so it's about government, yeah? There's ocracy from the Greek, and its Latinate and French roots refers to government by a bunch of meritocrats. So you have this kind of idea of a social system. And then you also have, I think, meritocracy as a word which has changed in meaning, which is more of an ideology, which has been used and well, as I argue in the book, as a means for the plutocratic elite to gain more power. And there, you know, meritocracy as a discourse is quite mobile and I think can move through several different stages. It has moved through quite a lot of different stages in the course of its life since it's been coined in 1956, possibly earlier. I think there are still earlier usages of the term that are out there, awaiting some diligent historian to uncover. So it means a social system on the one hand, and it also means a discourse, an ideological discourse on the other. And then there's traffic between those systems, between those meanings, rather. Because the way in which meritocracy moves from having, it starts out in the 50s as meaning something quite negative. So for the industrial sociologist Alan Fox, meritocracy is a system which is inherently bad. You know, he kind of uses it to describe a social system which is nonsensical. For him, the idea that you have a social system which gives extra rewards to people who are already prodigiously gifted is ludicrous. You know, why should they get extra economic rewards? And he thinks that, you know, instead you should have perhaps a system of cross-grading where people that work very hard are given more leisure time off, people that are given too much money, some of their wealth is removed from them and redistributed throughout society. So for Alan Fox, which is still the first recorded use of the word meritocracy, he still makes that first use of the term. It's something which is automatically negative. And then it is for Michael Young as well. He has a more gentle, satirical use of the term in many ways, I think. But nonetheless, in his book, The Rise of the Meritocracy, it's something which he is pastiching, which he is critiquing. And then for Hannah Arendt, who also wrote an essay in the same year that Michael Young's book came out, which is mainly about education. For her, it's meritocracy is something inherently bad. You know, it's something which is against egalitarianism. And so there's been a move historically between those earlier uses of the term, in which it's a negative, it's something which isn't positively marked, towards its gradual rehabilitation, which starts to happen around the 1970s via Daniel Bell in particular, the guru with the knowledge economy, who tries to think about, partly because he exists in a system where there's a strong welfare state, there's this kind of strong backing for people to move up the social ladder to start with. He starts to think about how meritocracy can be an engine for the knowledge economy, how it can be used as an engine of growth, and then it becomes a more positively charged term. Then by the 80s, you have kind of a range of think tanks on the right using meritocracy positively, and actually in Britain trying to use it to push to privatise education. So it's kind of interesting that you have this term that's moved in a very volatile fashion in terms of its value. That's changed, and it is used to encourage particular types of social structure. So I think one kind of really important facet of meritocracy, which doesn't appear often in the dictionary definitions, but is nonetheless there in its use, is the idea that you heap economic rewards on people that are perceived to have merit. And that is where a kind of fundamental problem with the whole idea of meritocracy comes into play, because once you heap vast economic rewards on the prodigiously gifted, you have a profoundly unequal society, and you have a group of people who tend to pass on those economic rewards to their children, thereby making the system itself a nonsense.
I mean, that's, I guess, one of the five problems that you kind of offer up as the kind of critical moment on meritocracy. And as you said, you know, in some readings of it, it's quite hard to argue against, you know, because it's got a sense of kind of, you know, rewarding hard work or talent or whatever. And we've lost, I guess, the kind of satirical critical moment which has been attached to the initial definitions. The problems, I think, are crucial because they set up both your broader kind of theoretical engagement with the term, but then also your practical analysis of cultural manifestations. So if inequality is one of them, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the other four, which are around, I guess, the kind of ideas about hierarchy, this problem of claiming things like talent and hard work as sort of innate, the fact that for some people life is just much harder in terms of climbing ladders or whatever, and then this kind of sense of like escaping things and, you know, I guess the kind of fundamentally untransformative nature of meritocracy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so what's wrong with meritocracy? Yeah, in other words. So firstly, I think it sets up a system, a linear system of competition, which is symbolised by the ladder, the idea of the ladder of opportunity, which has been used by a broad range of politicians in the US, the UK, and in Australia. So the opposition leader, Mark Latham, in the early 2000s in Australia, used to be called Lord of the Rungs because he referred to this idea of the ladder of opportunity so much. And it's, you can find it in quotes from Ayn Rand, kind of early modernist guru of liberalism. So you have, it endorses this system of a hierarchical ladder, which I think, again, I'm very keen on returning to the early critiques of meritocracy, particularly not so much Young, perhaps, as the earlier kind of Arendt, Alan Fox, and Raymond Williams, who talked about it very briefly in a book review. But he has a very kind of arch critique of meritocracy. And he talks in particular about how the idea of the ladder of opportunity is really problematic because you go up it one at a time. Yeah, it's the kind of archetypal symbol of bourgeois society. You can't all progress on a ladder at the same time. And he says that it sweetens the poison of hierarchy, and it kind of works to mitigate against the task of common betterment, which again is something I think it's really important to refer to. Because meritocracy, as it's been developed, particularly under the neoliberal period, has been very concerned with individualistic competitive advancement. And, you know, this is profoundly problematic because it works to kind of validate and push forward agendas for inequality. So that's the first problem, I think, the idea that it's linear, that it's a competitive linear system that's profoundly hierarchical. Secondly, there's a problem which often happens when meritocracy is being referred to or talked about, which is about essentialism and innateness. And I think this problem isn't always there. So it's possible to have to talk about meritocracy and not be essentialist. But often when it's being discussed, often ideas of innate skill, the talent which is just inside someone, which needs to be released, is palpably present. And you can see this particularly in education, I think, in the way in which particularly noxious discourses of neoliberal meritocracy work on the assumption, as actually Toby Young has promoted recently, you know, the idea that IQ is embedded in a person and just will out, in a predetermined way. So it can function to re-embed essentialist stereotypes around merit, I think. It doesn't have to do that, but it often can and does. And thirdly, you have the factor that in a neoliberal meritocratic system, it's just simply much harder for some people to get onto the rungs of the ladder than others. So we have this idea of the ladder of opportunity that's available for anyone to climb, but that bypasses the very real palpable fact that some people are further up the ladder to begin with than others in terms of their social privilege, in terms of their economic background. So, for instance, if you think about musical instruments, who has the time and the possibility to actually, you know, use and practice on a musical instrument, that's affected by your social background, as sociologists have talked about forever. So meritocracy as a kind of ladder of opportunity tends to bypass that. Yeah, it doesn't talk about who is already at the top particularly. It just conjures up this image of a ladder of opportunity where we're all positioned at the bottom, or also the idea of a level playing field, yeah, which we don't have. So there's that. There's also the fact that, and this kind of pans back to the linear aspect, is the problem of rankings, yeah, the problem of hierarchy in terms of meritocracy valorizing particular types of job and particular types of attributes and people. So the way in which it can come to endorse certain positions which are deemed as being socially valuable, as which are understood as being at the top of the ladder, tends not to come along with the question, you know, why is it that we're positioning this as something to aspire to? So there's the whole question of ranking and progression and how particular occupations are being valorized over others. So why isn't, you know, a nurse or a vet being positioned as something that you've really made if you're making it up the social ladder? And then on top of that, you have the fifth problem, which is meritocracy as a narrative or discourse which is being used to promote this idea of equality of opportunity, whilst at the same time it actively works to segment inequality. So its function as a ideological discourse and myth.
And this has come along embedded in particular political projects, I guess, as a couple of chapters in the first half of the book do, you'd situate this in the transition or I mean, maybe the project to destroy social democracy and turn it into a kind of present conjecture. So could you give me a sort of sketch of that kind of post-68 transformation of social democracy through, you know, you point towards in the UK, things like the politics of Thatcherism and where meritocracy kind of fits in as maybe both the ideology and also as a kind of social system that's often gestured to but not at all realised.
Yeah. Well, you can think about that, I think, in terms of how how different political regimes have adopted the idea of meritocracy and worked with it. And then you can also think about the broader social trends and social changes that have happened since that moment. So I guess to take the latter, I would say very broadly that neoliberalism as it emerges from the 1970s as a political project tries to kind of suck up almost some of the lifeblood of the social movements for liberation around anti-racism, around feminism, around environmentalism and sexual equality. And it kind of takes some of those elements discursively on board as part of the narrative of neoliberal meritocracy. So, for example, I talked at the beginning about I started to get interested in meritocracy in the 2000s. And that's a moment when it's kind of like the zenith of neoliberal meritocracy, I think, in some ways, because it's a moment when the idea that anyone can make it regardless of their background, regardless of their ethnicity and their gender, is really being quite heavily pushed in popular culture and discourse. Yeah. And it's not quite the same now. I think it's that discourse has moved in particular ways after the financial crash 2007-08. So you can see how that narrative has changed, and politicians such as David Cameron, Theresa May have increasingly referred to the fact that it is more difficult for people to progress up the social ladder. And in the book, I call these neoliberal justice narratives because they recognise injustice, and what they do is prescribe corporate solutions for inequality, basically. So I'm very interested in how meritocracy as a neoliberal discourse mutates. It doesn't just say the same thing. It offers different versions of itself. It offers different versions of the narrative that says everyone can have equality of opportunity, if only. So part of the project of the book is really tracing how those narratives have changed. And I'm quite interested as part of that in how this idea of what I call a kind of meritocratic deficit is conjured up, which is loosely the argument that some people face conditions of injustice, such as women, such as people who aren't white. And they are positioned as being able to make it as well, as long as they work extra hard. Yeah. So in a sense, they face this double egalitarian deficit, this double meritocratic deficit, where not only are they positioned further down the ladder to start with, but they are encouraged to work twice as hard to get up it, which is kind of exhausting and usually impossible. So I'm interested in how politicians have kind of negotiated that. And I've got a chapter in the book where I look at how politicians in the UK have negotiated that, which I think is really interesting if you drill down into the specifics of it, because you can see, so for example, Margaret Thatcher appeals very much to a kind of class mobility. You know, you can think about how the kind of stereotypes that abound at the time of Thatcherism are around the yuppie. It's like Harry Enfield's character, loads of money, a working class guy who makes lots of dosh. It's all about kind of economic mobility and being able to show you're at the top of the ladder through your consumer spending. So it's a very kind of specific articulation of meritocracy at that time. And it's one that's also designed to appeal to women in particular, women as consumers, whilst at the same time it's quite socially traditional and moralistic. And then that narrative kind of mutates. So by the time you get to Tony Blair, who is one of the politicians in the modern era to use the word meritocracy incredibly frequently, even more than Theresa May, you have, under Blairism, you have a more socially liberal version of meritocracy, whereby feminism and anti-racism are embraced as long as they are compatible loosely with neoliberal capitalism. Yeah. So that's kind of socially liberal version of meritocracy, where you have collective provision being pushed for early years, but after that, in people's adult lives, they are, you know, abandoned to the market loosely, and the kind of the systems of social welfare, notoriously, that were there in the 50s, are being snipped away and privatised by Labour, just as they were under Thatcher, which is why Thatcher says that Blair is one of her greatest success stories. So kind of neoliberal meritocracy changes in its register. And then I think by the time you get to, say, David Cameron, and who has promotes this idea of an aspiration nation, it's changing again. So then you have very much this discourse, which is more moralistic, which is more punitive in many ways, which is making a distinction between strivers and skivers. So it becomes a moral obligation to climb the ladder. Yeah. And if you don't, you're not only a loser, you're letting down your family, you're letting down society, you know, and you need to be castigated for it. So that's kind of when the very vindictive element of neoliberal meritocracy really takes off, I think, under austerity. And then again, with Theresa May, when she first came to power, she very much wanted to offer a kind of red Toryism that was different. And you know, then the Sun famously calls her offer one of Mayritocracy. Yeah. So she's with the speech she makes at the beginning of becoming prime minister is all about, you know, how she's going to help the poor on the council estates, how she's going to make sure that black people have just as much opportunities as white people, how she's going to make it easier for mothers. But it's all prescribing very individualistic, capitalistic, competitive solutions to those problems of inequality again. So, yeah, so I was interested in how meritocracy mutates as a political discourse, as a, you know, kind of structure of feeling.
And that kind of closes the first half of the book. And it's interesting, obviously, you reference structures of feeling, and it strikes me that the second half of the book is the other side of that project of cultural studies, which is to analyse how these political projects and discourses manifest themselves in our kind of everyday lives. And there's a whole bunch of examples that you use in different ways. And I mean, we can sort of jump around these, but maybe we could start by thinking about one of the things you gestured towards, which is essentially the top of the ladder in the meritocratic metaphor being untouched by any of these social changes. And you use examples from things like the British Royal Family or the TV show The Apprentice, you know, just got British and American versions, Downton Abbey, which has been this really successful export for the UK television industry, but all have, I guess, a kind of a mode of meritocracy that essentially reinforces elites' positions. And you use this term kind of normcore elite. So it'd be nice to hear a bit about, I guess, the kind of the story of meritocracy as a kind of reactionary moment within contemporary culture.
Yeah. I think I was partly interested in including those types of case studies from, you know, popular culture, because meritocracy has been discussed kind of interestingly, I think, in the academic literature. So there's a lot of attention in education studies in particular on its meaning. There's also quite a lot of interesting work in terms of social mobility studies in sociology, particularly in the States. But I thought that one place where it really seemed to be kind of lacking sustained investigation was in terms of its circulation in popular discourse and popular culture in any kind of, you know, detailed way. And I was also interested in its genealogies as well, because they, you know, the first half of the book is devoted to that, to thinking about genealogies of the term, because they haven't been talked about in any kind of sustained detail, I think, either. You know, there's quite a lot of work on Michael Young, but it tends to stop there, and a lot of the earlier precursors are bypassed on the whole. So that's what I was interested in doing. And I think it's also interesting because if you kind of move back for those genealogies, there are a lot of kind of earlier stories you could tell, and I'd quite like to work on extending it sometime in thinking about the kind of transnational linkages of meritocracy in the past as well as in the present. But yeah, so the second part of the book is all about what I call parables of progress. So how media narratives in particular and cultural forms of cultural production encourage us to think about meritocracy as offering examples of progress, and the particular narratives and stories are spotlighted as being emblematic of meritocratic success. So in terms of the rich, I was interested in how the rich use discourses of meritocracy to justify their position. And I was interested in how what I call there's this kind of particular mode of self-presentation by the rich of themselves as just being like us, as being normal, as being ordinary, and in particular in terms of them working very hard. Yeah. This is something Seamus Khan also talks about in his great book, Privilege, when he's talking about elite pupils at a kind of upstate New York school and how they have to show, carefully calibrate the types of work that they do and show that they're working hard but not too hard. But it's similar in a way to the kind of upper echelons of the elite in media discourse, I think, in Britain. So, for example, I was interested in how CEOs in particular publish narratives of and autobiographies of how they made it. And you can see it in The Apprentice, as you mentioned, is a very emblematic example of this. So you have people, you know, some people like Alan Sugar, who did kind of work their way up through the social system in a more convincing way. And then you have other people like Trump, who got given billions to start with, so obviously didn't. But both of them use this narrative of deserving it through their incredible hard work. Yeah. So this narrative that the rich deserve to be there because they have worked in a savvy, entrepreneurial and sustained way is really common. And I was very interested in that. And I was interested in how that kind of functions as well in terms of narratives, media narratives, such as Downton. So Downton is very interesting because it's presenting a version of the past, but it's also not an accident that this story of extreme wealth and extreme poverty is hugely popular in the present. And there's a lot of ways in which the rich are figured in that as deserving their wealth. You know, they're figured as kind parents a lot of the time. And they're figured as also interestingly as kind of actively working in entrepreneurial fashions to deserve their wealth in a way that isn't always strictly historically accurate, but which maps onto the ways in which the rich present themselves in the present. So I'm kind of interested in how rich mobilise discourses of being worth it as a way to justify their billions.
Why do you hate Matt Damon?
Okay, so the first chapter is about class, pretty much. And the second chapter is more about the racialization of meritocracy. And the third chapter in part two is about gender. So why do I hate Matt Damon? I don't hate Matt Damon, but I was very interested in how this kind of scandal blew up around Matt Damon. Actually, there's been several scandals.
Matt Damon.
But this one was about a TV show that he co-presented with Ben Affleck called Project Greenlight, which is an HBO series, which is a reality show designed to help wannabe film directors and producers break into the industry of Hollywood, which is, you know, notoriously guarded, difficult to get into. So in many ways, this TV show is offering a kind of meritocratic bubble of possibility and opportunity for its contestants to work within. And there have been several series of Project Greenlight. And there was a problem by the end of the second series because it became clear that out of all the contestants by the end, they were basically a bunch of white men being interviewed and judged by a bunch of white men. So, you know, it's very recognisable in terms of the scandal that's blown up at the moment around Weinstein and Hollywood and rich white men being in power. But Project Greenlight came back for a third series more recently in 2015. And they were very anxious to make it a little bit more diverse because this bubble of meritocracy wasn't really happening. So they included Effie Brown, the producer of Dear White People and In the Cut. And there was a scene during Project Greenlight, the third series, when Effie Brown raised some issues really about the problems with this particular episode. And she had a problem because she thought that the only person of colour in this script is a prostitute. And, you know, you perhaps need to think about who you're choosing as a director as well and what their background is. Perhaps she just, you know, very carefully raised the point that you might take this into consideration. And Matt Damon talked across her. He white-splained or mansplained or Damon-splained, as the phrase that emerged put it. He talked across her and said, that's not how you do diversity. You don't do diversity in film production. You do it later on in casting. And this scene where he talked across her and she just, afterwards she just goes, oof, okay. It went viral basically in the States. And there were loads of kind of tweets in particular about it with the hashtag Damonsplaining, kind of comedy tweets saying, I hope Matt Damon can tell me why the cage bird sings. I need to ring Matt Damon up and get him to recommend a good stylist for my dreads, that kind of thing. So it became this kind of widely mocked incident, but also a kind of telling incident of the way in which merit was being racialized. Because afterwards, when he apologized, he said, I apologize if I have offended anyone, but we need to employ people on the basis of merit. So all of the issues around the kind of white privilege and kind of gender privilege that were ingrained in that and were so palpable early on to so many people in the series were being bypassed and pushed aside by him, and even pushed aside in his apology. So in that chapter, I looked at that as a way into talking about how merit is racialized and referred it back not only to the film industry, but also to other institutional issues around racialization, such as education, Harvard's admission policies, for example. And then I also was interested in it in a way in which that racialization was being challenged now, because part of why I think it's important to think about meritocracy as a discourse which affects what people think about how society is organized and how power functions is also another part of that is also the fact that it can be changed. Yeah, it's quite live, it's quite mutable, it can be contested. So I was interested in how this discourse of racialized meritocracy can be challenged, can be confronted, and what some of the, you know, potential and limitations of that might be. So that's where that chapter ended up.
And I guess the logical thing then is the comparison with gender. And you use, I guess, a kind of a figure that's emerged, this mompreneur. Mm-hmm. Although there are kind of like, is it three different kind of ways of pronouncing that?
Yeah. Mompreneur.
What is the mompreneur?
Okay.
And what does that tell us about the relationship between gender and meritocracy?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the mompreneur is is a trope, yeah, or a social type, and it refers to a woman who is a mother and who works at home, basically setting up a business from her kitchen table while her kid crawls beneath it. So this kind of trope has, and this idea has been popularized over the past couple of decades. There's now a Daily Mail Mompreneur of the Year competition. Annabelle Carmel, who is kind of famous for her kids' recipe books, also published a book called Mompreneur, which is designed to help you think about how you might balance kids with setting up your own business. And there's a kind of whole rash of books and novels, kind of chick lit books, chick lits that have grown up into hens, henlets, Henlett books that are talking about how mothers balance these contradictory issues. And I was really interested in how mumpreneurs are being pushed as a solution, basically. They're being pushed as a meritocratic solution, as a way in which you can take gender difficulty and use it as a means of pushing yourself up the ladder, and how this is very, very widely celebrated in women's magazines, in, you know, Sunday supplements, as well as in tabloids like the Daily Mail, as a marker of success, as a marker of very possible and very glamorous success. But obviously, if you drill down into it a bit more, as some people like Carol Ecken-Smith has done some really great quantitative survey work on real-life mompreneurs, the story is less rosy, and it tends to be women who have considerable financial capital to begin with, who are able to do this, and who can, you know, park their kids for a substantial part of the day with nannies who actually manage to make it work. Yeah. So there's, like so many meritocratic narratives, there's a glaring disjunct between what gets offered, spotlighted and made luminous as a story of success, a parable of progress, and the reality of other people who are left behind at the bottom of the ladder. And I was interested in it more broadly because it was a kind of neoliberal trope that's being offered to women. And it's a way of kind of trying to deal with some of the problems that of social reproduction broadly, you know, some of the problems that women face around employment and gender discrimination, and some of the issues around childcare, which has still never been sorted out, which are still not equitable. And it's a way, the mumpreneur, as I see it, is a way of kind of papering over those cracks to a large extent, a way of avoiding them, a way of kind of bypassing the problem that we don't have enough available childcare that's subsidised by the state, that we don't have enough kind of maternity and paternity leave that can be shared for long enough, and we don't have other ways of working which people can negotiate and according to what they want, and we have very often very inflexible working conditions as well for people when they do go back to work. You have the right to request flexible working, but you don't have the right to get it. So it was a way of thinking about how mompreneur is a kind of plaster, a band-aid for all these problems of social reproduction. And it's being offered to women as something enticing and exciting and glamorous. And I was interested as well in how women are encouraged to brand themselves through that. So how the kind of complexities of branding yourself as a mother and in putting your family online and your life online.
What I suppose are the kind of alternatives, not just in terms of, you know, the need for a different political system that would, you know, give us a more equitable social order and would deal with questions of social reproduction with regards to gender, class and race, but also culturally, I think. And this is one of the things you talk a little bit about in the conclusion, because obviously there is, as the book identifies, you know, this important relationship between these cultural expressions, these political systems and these ideologies of meritocracy. So what are the kind of cultural, I guess, practical political alternatives?
Okay, well, I guess one part of the story is that we sometimes have a very singular understanding of merit, and that's partly what a lot of the neuroses and anxieties that are bred in this system of neoliberal meritocracy circulate around. They circulate a very partial system of validation that can only praise a few people who reach what's demarcated as the top of the social pile. So I think to begin with, we need to pluralise understandings of merit, yeah, to recognise that there are lots of facets and attributes that we need socially and which should be valorised. So I'd like to pluralise our understanding of merit to begin with. And there's lots of really great work that has done that in sociology. For example, there's a really good book called Inequality by Design, which has a very kind of nuanced take on that. So we need to kind of pluralise our understanding of merit, I think. And then a lot of this is about neoliberal meritocracy is about functioning as a cloak or an alibi for elites that want to hoover up more wealth. So, and a lot of the problems around it, and which make it structurally impossible, are the fact that you have this incredibly long social ladder with incredibly massive distance between the rich and the poor, which is just widening, as we know. You know, Oxfam's report on 62 people own the same wealth as the rest of the world came out the other year, and it's only been increasing since then. So part of the issues are, a crucial part of this is just about extending forms of economic equality. Yeah? So how you might think about that on the ground can take a number of different forms. You know, we've had the Paradise Papers or the Parasite Papers being published this week. It's making offshore tax havens illegal, making sure they don't function. It's making sure I fully support the High Wage Commission, for example, High Pay Commission. It's kind of using a whole battery of strategies which are out there to think about removing this obscene division in wealth, you know, which has become, you know, the same as the kind of, it's kind of the new Gilded Age, isn't it? It's not been seen for 100 years, this kind of extremes between wealth and poverty. So we need to pluralise merit. We need to work on strategies of redistributing wealth. And then I think we also need systems in place that are designed to reduce discrimination. Yeah. So, you know, you can see this again with all the controversy over Weinstein and Me Too. You need systems in place that make abuses of power, that outlaw it, yeah, and make sure that the different norms around working cultures can be embedded in a meaningful way. And then we also need socialised forms of provision, so which function on a kind of non-authoritarian basis, so mutual cooperative forms of provision that mean we can share the wealth, you know, which mean we can have encourage cooperatives. So non-authoritarian forms of social provision, socialisation are key, I think.
Are these kind of things you're going to be, I guess, working on in the future, or have you kind of settled your accounts with meritocracy, social justice, social transformation, and now you're going to do something completely different?
Well, I'm working tentatively on a project called The End of Social Mobility, which is looking at all the current challenges to ideas of social mobility, which see it as a dead end, more or less, and which think it's run out of steam. So I'm interested in that, in the challenges to the whole narrative and idea of social mobility as a problematic fiction and what it might be replaced with. So that's one project. I also have various other ideas. Like, I'm working on a piece at the moment, a journal article, which is about Trump and his elevator.
Nice.
So I'm looking at the elevator, the golden elevator, as opposed to the ladder, and how that functions in relation to that trope, as well as all the, you know, leave EU tax haven plutocrats that are in the lift, trying to trace through some of the material dynamics there in relation to the idea of the ladder. And then I also have, yeah, various other projects on the go about environmentalism that are working their way through.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Dr. Joe Littler about Against Meritocracy, Culture, Power and Myths of Mobility.